Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. Andre here, but I actually am not in the episode that you are about to hear. You are going to enjoy a conversation between Owen and Devang Desai from the Open Era podcast about all things Australian Open, upsets, predictions, the American Man, and the new series from Netflix, Breakpoint. And you can actually even go up and tell us what you think of it. Anyways, enjoy and have a nice day. Bye.
You know, like a week and a half into the Australian Open now, almost. What's the feeling been for you so far?
Good question, and I won't pause too long because this is an audio medium, and that's not good. I honestly, America, I'm not pandering, Owen, because I know you do hail from the United States, but the American men being relevant again, it reminded me of when I really got into watching tennis, and it was a nostalgic feeling that I was surprised by how much I loved it. And we're in a weird spot in Canada. I know we're very close and we have so many common ties and so many commonalities in general, but I think there was always that rivalry and it had spread to tennis. And seeing the Canadians in general enjoy a lot of success recently, we were relishing that, but I also was kind of missing the American men being relevant deep into tournaments. And I was reading something in the Times today about how the last time American men met this late, it was Marty Fish and Andy Roddick, which is crazy to me, right? Like, that is wild.
Yeah.
And even to consider that the last time an American male player made the final was 2009, like, that's 14 years ago. So this is cool. They're likable in their own way. I think I've said before, right? I love watching Tommy Paul generally, and Ben Shelton as well is a revelation in the fact that Tommy Paul's taken him under his wing and now they're going to play. It's just really cool. So I'm going to go with the American men, which you cannot say for any other aspect of society these days, Owen. I'm going to applaud the American men.
How true is that? My God. I think the U.S. needs to milk this tournament as much as they can. But yeah, going back a little bit, you said, this wasn't really a feeling you had since you got into tennis. I actually don't know that story. Like, when did you get into tennis and what did things look like then?
It was Pete Sampras. It was Pete Sampras and Andre. And my dad loved Pete Sampras a lot. And because of that, I gravitated to him as well. But I would say I really did start watching tennis a lot in the mid to late 90s. And obviously the landscape was quite different and the accessibility was way off. But I really enjoyed getting up early to watch Breakfast at Wimbledon and hearing the music and getting the NBC call and getting a young John McEnroe, who as a commentator back then is absolutely incredible. I'm like, right. Wow,
he's gotten
he
worse.
Was good. Yeah. He's like, yeah, like, really. But I recommend going back to listen to him back in the day, AKA not that long ago, when he was quite salient and had his finger on the pulse. Cause I think the other thing is that I felt like maybe we have too much information. That seems like a weird thing to say. But back then, I was ignorant of a lot of things that maybe at the time it was right. It was correct that I didn't know as much as I should have. And I watched the sport differently that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think like that is sort of a goal of commentary and maybe even like mainstream tennis podcasts like the Tennis Podcast, because they're sort of aiming at that maybe more general audience where you say something that seems obvious to a hardcore fan and to like a newcomer, it's like revelatory. But yeah, when you like take that step into hardcore, then like suddenly certain things seem obvious and certain things it's like, is this just flat out wrong? So it's kind of an interesting transition to make. On the American men, what's impressed you about them? And I guess between Tommy Paul and Ben Shelton, which one do you think has more upside?
Ooh, I don't want to be a draw guy, but Ben Shelton's had a pretty fortunate route, you could say, so far. And again, you can only play the people in front of you, but I think he would be the first to admit that it's been fortunate so far. The JJ Wolf match, impressive the way he dug, but the level he's going to have to get to against Tommy Paul, I'm not sure if he's ready for that yet. I mentioned the fact that they're boys, but I don't think they've played each other ever. So that aspect to me, I would favor the 25-year-old. I really like Tommy Paul, Owen. Like, I know he skews a bit older in the next gen conversation, and we could probably retire the next gen conversation because they're all just probably here and playing well now, right? Like, I don't think we don't need to preface anything by saying how old these people are, how young they are. I think they're all ready to compete. But Tommy Paul, fantastic to watch aesthetically. I think he is now, I think he always was able to grind, and the fact that he can mix grinding with some really just supremely sublime ground strokes makes him such a treat to watch for me. And the service motion is another aspect of that as well. So I, as a purist in the sense of just enjoying watching someone play, I put all my chips in the Tommy Paul basket.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think he's quite good at taking the ball on the rise, which is sort of antithetical to the Isners and the Opelkas of the world. So I do like with the American men that we have some more variety in the play styles now. Like, you have you have Brooksby, who's super unconventional. They're
unwatchable. Unwatchable for some Owen as well.
Fair enough. And you have some who actually have really good backhands now. I mean, Fritz has a great backhand, and I think Tiafoe's is really good as well. And that's another thing where it's like they're getting better, but I think they're also evolving out of that, you know, surfboard archetype, which is nice to see.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of common in tennis, but you have like these groups of players that end up growing up together and playing together a bunch. It's fascinating to me to see the range of ages now for this American crew, and I think the prevalence of the college tennis scene and how much that is impacting the U.S. talent pool. I don't know if the USTA planned for that. I know they made changes in 2008 and they reorganized their system, but the idea of just generating as many players as you can, giving as many players an opportunity as you can, not having them having to move away from their family and train, and having these more sporadic camps, and then having them go to school, frankly.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure that was the way to do it. Because I think we saw the rise of Europe and the fact that these guys are turning pro as soon as they could. It didn't seem right, you know, but watching them play now, it's a notch in the college column.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think tennis in general is moving away from that teen champion thing. I mean, you have Alcaraz, but I think if you're not a generational talent, sure, you can go pro at 18, 19, but you're not going to start really winning anything big until 4, 5, 6 years after that. So I think you're right. Like, why not, you know, wait until you're that age already, and then maybe you're a little bit more prepared by the time you hit the pro scene.
I think Ben Shelton's still in school, right? Like, he's getting his degree. Why not, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You can go to class anywhere these days, so.
Right. Yeah, and if the pro career tanks, then you have a solid backup as well.
Exactly.
Although things are looking pretty good.
Yeah, he might be all right. Might be all right.
Yeah. Kind of in general with the men's tournament, do you see anyone besides Djokovic winning?
No, but I believe that could happen more now than I did at the beginning of the tournament. Mm-hmm. I'll say that for what that's worth. I'm not sure if it's much, but the injury conversation I found fascinating because the players are chiming in now.
Yeah.
And we get an insight in what they consider being injured. But I can empathize with Novak in the sense that, like, everyone is hurting. And I don't think it's always him that's playing this up. I think, like we see most of the time, it's a tribal war online from Indeed. Factions of fans who are just waging their wars. And I think for Novak, I'm like, he's probably not feeling super great that his hamstring is like touch and go, and then sometimes he looks fine and sometimes he doesn't look fine. So I don't think he will lose. I think he's gonna win still, but I think it happened again, Owen. Stefanos has fooled me again into believing he has a shot in hell in this final. I know it might be the stupidest thing I could ever believe in again, but
no, maybe. I mean, I don't think it's crazy. Like, and I want to get into a bunch of the stuff you talked about because I also think the injury thing is fascinating. But I mean, at the very least, he's got the game to make Novak work, right? And I think in the last round with Djokovic against Demonor, when everyone was like, oh, he's so clearly not injured, to me, there was a very simple explanation for why he looked fine, which was that, like, Demonor couldn't do anything to him. He had no
Nothing.
weapons, couldn't push him
Nothing.
around. If this is an injury that makes itself clear when Djokovic is defending on the backhand side, and you have someone who's not going to make him defend on the backhand side, he's probably going to look pretty good. And I think that was what happened.
No, totally. Totally. Could you say this is the best place for Steph to play Novak, oddly enough? Like, do you like his chances better at in Paris?
I
I
do
know
like
he.
them better in Paris because I think he
Yeah.
has more time on the return. I think here there's still the risk that Novak will just serve him off the court. But Steph does do well here. I mean, this is his third semifinal run in a row. He's gone deeper than Medvedev this year. Clearly he likes it here. So the crowd likes him. Not that that's going to make a difference against Djokovic, but yeah, clearly he feels like he does well here.
The cringe posting is amplifying. He's
Oh,
doing
yeah.
like a weird Australian accent now with his post-match. I don't know what's going on. Way, if it works, it works. Sure, go get that slam. Did Novak? He didn't throw shade, but Novak forgetting they played in a final already was interesting to me because I don't want to say it's intentional, but the mind games have begun already.
Yeah, and I really wanted to talk about that because that was wild to me. Like, it's not like this was your random major final. Like, if he had forgotten.
That wasn't 20 years ago. It's not
Exactly.
like this happened like in 2007, Novak.
And not just that, but he came back from two sets to love down to win at his
Was a
worst
big deal.
major. It was an
It was a big
incredibly
deal.
memorable match. It wasn't like
Was a big deal.
if he forgot that he played Kevin Anderson in 2018, it's like, sure, you can have that one. But like,
Right.
and this, I watched his reaction, and when they reminded him, he was like, oh, sorry, sorry, you're right. Like, it looked completely unintentional, like he just forgot. Like, how is that possible?
It's a bit sickening. He's won that many times. That's probably how, right? Like
Yeah.
when you've been in these spots that many times. But psychologically, here's what I'm down to in terms of like, can Novak lose? Psychologically, who can push him? Who can make him feel uncomfortable? Who can make that hamstring feel bad once again? Honestly, if Tommy Paul is at his full peak, his full flight, he gives him a go, but not enough to beat him. And then Khachanov. Maybe, but will we see that in the final? Probably not. I think
Right.
nerves cannot be understated in situations like these. And the notch in Steph's column is that he's been here before, and you would hope that he has learned some things in his during or during his trials and tribulations at this level.
Yeah, I would hope so too. It's interesting because I think a lot of it also depends on what Novak shows up, what version of him shows up. Like, I
Right.
think going into the Demonor match, a lot of people kind of assumed that it would be like the pusher Novak, like the one who kind of showed up for the Brooks v match at the US Open. And if it was pusher Djokovic, then I think it would have been a war. But, he came out blasting every forehand, and so it was a massacre. And so I think if that guy shows up, no one has a chance. But yeah, I mean, Tsitsipas, like, he's got the forehand, like, he has things he can do. Rublev, I honestly think Rublev could cause more damage than people think, just because he has the firepower to move Novak around a bit.
Yeah, the Holger Rune match. I mean,
Oh, man.
because I mean, if Novak was going to be taken down, I don't think a lot of people probably penciled Holger Rune as maybe being that guy because he had done it
Yeah.
recently and he looks pretty damn great for his experience level. Oh, really? Yeah, this is the Andrei Rublev conundrum though because he doesn't get his due. He kind of waltzes by some very tough early round opponents. He's played Dominic Thiem, Rusevori, Dan Evans, Holger Rune.
Jeez, yeah,
That's
that's
a pr
tough. I didn't realize.
is there a tougher quartet of opponents anyone has played thus far to make it to the quarterfinals? I don't think so. I think
Not
that's
on the
pretty
men's
damn
side.
impressive,
Yeah.
right? So the interesting thing is that psychologically, I really, really want to see Andrei Rublev pump himself up and back himself in this match and
Yeah.
not fall into old patterns because I think the game speaks for itself and all his fellow tour players talk about his game and how ridiculous it is. But I think between the years against someone like Novak, He can't afford any slippage at all. And that's kind of been his problem. So,
yeah, I agree. I mean, the Runa match, like, so I was there and it was kind of like a torturous experience, especially the last yeah. few minutes, because
that Tyrick was weird as hell.
Oh my God. Weird as bizarre. Hell. And even the few minutes before that, because Runa was up 5-3 serving for the match. And then he just lost 8 points in a row for like no discernible reason. And then he had match points and it was like, okay, now he's going to do it. And then Rublev got out of that and then promptly went down like 5-0 in the tiebreak. But yeah, I mean, he really did like buckle down at the end. You had that swing volley hit to the wrong side of the court on match point. And then I think at 9-all, he came to net again and won the point. And I thought that was very brave because I thought he was just going to be mentally shattered after that. But I think against Novak, like, I just don't see it. I think it's between the years, like you said, but I also think Rublev is just not really cut out for a baseline war of attrition against him.
He's got to have the day of his life, and Novak has to have probably one of his worst performances in recent time, I think, for this to happen. And that's not a slight at Rublev at all. I think that is just the combination of Novak being Novak and the aura he has at this tournament, which shouldn't be underestimated either. Like, there's a reason he's won so many damn times here. Like, it is very hard to beat him in Australia.
I think that's exactly it. And that's the dynamic with the injury thing. Like, he's borderline invincible here. So the fact that he's got this hamstring thing, like, I do think it exists, but I don't think it matters, if that makes sense. Like, you watch the Dimitrov match, and Djokovic was not himself there. Like, he's letting these winners go by. He's falling down, and he wins in straights. And, you know, part of that was because Dimitrov couldn't take his chances because he's Dimitrov. But, you know, he, like, something needs to be badly, badly wrong for him to lose to someone like that.
And yet, I enjoyed watching that match a lot. Maybe because Gregor Pugh's channel, Gregor was channeling some late aughts Federer there in some of those scratch strokes. Also, by Novak not returning things, but no, I think you're right. And I basically where I've netted out is that I want to see the best tennis I can for the remainder of this tournament, and I'm trying to imagine matchups. What would look the best? Like Novak, Tommy Paul, Novak, Steph. I think that would be interesting. It'd be an interesting level that Djokovic would have to hit with his hammy to beat those guys because there's no slouches at all.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'll be disappointed if we don't get a Novak Steph final because I think I think on the men's side there's kind of been a lack of, you know, besides matches involving Sir Andrew Murray, a lack of like really epic matches. I think Tsitsipas Sinner kind of qualifies, but besides that, Murray Berrettini and Murray Kokkinakis, I kind of struggle to think of, like, okay, what matches were really, really awesome?
That's true, right? Like, Andy Murray kind of propped this tournament up to start with. The Sheldon Wolf match was pretty good. I think we've also, as a society, realized that extremely long matches aren't necessarily good. Like, there's there's a lot of down periods that just zip by because someone is playing terribly and that's all. Like, you're just going through the motions of getting to the fifth set. So that bar or that fine line between long and good, we're being more choosy, Owen, which is good. I think we've moved past the idea of things like equal, always being good if they're long. And we did that a lot, I think, in tennis. And now we're being choosier. And again, I don't think altering the way we score this sport would be a bad idea. But I think a lot of people are hanging on to the idea of five sets desperately because they're automatically epics.
Yeah, I think you're right. And like, that's something I've kind of noticed being here. Like, I used to be one of the people where it was like, and I still do defend by best of five sets. I think
me too, by the way. Me too, just for the record. I think so.
good to know. But like, being here, it's like, no one watches every single point of a match. Like, you're gonna do it sometimes, but like, you gotta take a bathroom break, you know, as the players know. Like, you're gonna look down at your phone and like miss a point sometimes, like that sort of thing. Like you said, long does not make good. And I, putting you on the spot a little bit, like, is there an example of like a really long match that people love where you're just like, yeah, that was not that great?
Oh God, I mean, this is a cop out, but did anyone think Isner Mahu is good at
Oh no
points?
way.
Did anyone was anyone like, holy cow, this is incredible at 30-30
I don't think so.
in Minnesota? I think so. There's a, I think it was Andy Roddick, Yunus Elanahui, at the
Oh yeah.
Australian Open years ago that I love. I still love that match to this day. And it was long-ish, but not really time-wise. I think it was just over 4 hours. But in my
Okay.
mind back then, that was the pinnacle. You're like, holy cow, they're leaving it all on the line. Andy Roddick, who at that time was moving into his lovable phase from
Yep.
his hateable phase, and you're like,
Right.
damn, you're cheering for this guy. I thought it was amazing, but I rewatched the match some years later. And I'm like, wow, okay, well, like I could take this or leave this. Like, this was not the pinnacle I thought it was. So I think there's a bunch of them. But that match, I think, is an example for me. There's a couple Leighton Hewitt matches as well. The one that the Hewitt Baghdatis match that the Murray match broke this year. I think there was times where you're like, this is an incredible slog, but it's the hilarity of it being so late at night and fans still being rowdy that made it captivating. So there's a few Federer matches in there as well. So not to be a homer, and when I say that it is a thing that I think we have just done. It's like an automatic thing.
No, I totally agree. I don't know how you feel about this one, but I rewatched the Djokovic Nadal like 6 hour one at the 2012 Australian Open a couple of times, and
Oh.
like that one quality wise does not hold up. Like it's one of my favorite matches. It's epic. It's exhausting. It was historically pivotal, but the first three sets are kind of garbage. Like the first hour, Djokovic is all over the place, and then hour two and three, Djokovic is just like battering Nadal into submission, and then it gets really good. But people talk about it as kind of like the
The war,
paragon of quality sometimes.
yeah.
I'm like, it's not what you think it is.
And don't forget, these guys are taking basically 40 minutes of between points at this
Yep.
point because the system they're employing, that's how meticulous they are before every point. Incredible, incredible theater. But holy cow, if you counted how much time, like I guess the length of the match when a ball was in play, I'd be fascinated to know what that is.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think that was actually the match that started like the serve clock debate because Pascal Murillo was the chair umpire and he didn't say anything to either of them, even though you had Nadal taking like 35 seconds between points at sometimes. I mean, I don't know, it was hot and they were killing each other, but you know. Anyway, got a little off track there, which is my bad. But so yeah, I guess to move on to the women, I think, which has been the more interesting tournament. Who do you think the favorite is right now? Because I think there are a lot of players who could take it. I think there are some players who initially seemed like favorites. Like I honestly thought Pegula was in very good shape, and then Azarenka destroyed her last night. So what are your thoughts?
Me too, regarding Pegula. I mean, this is the opposite of Tommy Paul and Ben Shelton in the sense that I think Azarenka and Pegula train all the time together. And I found it
Yeah.
very interesting that Azarenka was commenting, like knowing exactly where Pegula likes the ball
Right.
when she's in rally, and basically Azarenka threw the junk at her and it worked very damn well.
Yeah.
Rybakina, I mean, there's a large part of me that wants Rybakina to win another slam and be like, haha, I'm still here. You have to respect me.
Right.
I won Wimbledon fair and square, even though you didn't want to acknowledge it. But I do think this is the Sabalenka slam. Like, I think Sabalenka had a lot of people confident in her before this tournament, which could be the kiss of death if you're
Yeah.
a recent historian regarding her success at slam so far in her career. But she went into the lab and worked on her serve and is being really is modest is the word, but I think she's being genuine in the sense of how much of a problem it's been in her in
Yeah.
her the media she's done. I find that really endearing. She's playing really well, and I think that would be awesome to see as a kind of maiden slam for Aryna Sabalenka. So I think she is still my pick. I picked her before the tournament, but Rybakina has got a very smooth, easy game to watch. And yeah. we saw it at Wimbledon, but under the conditions in Melbourne, I think they also really pop.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think the thing that Sabalenka and Rybakina have in common, at least this tournament, is it seems like they play every single match on their terms, regardless right. of who they're playing. Yeah. Like, their games are so powerful, so imposing. Like, they're getting the first strike in against everyone. Like, Rybakina was overpowering Ostapenko, which is supposed to be impossible. So if she can do that. But yeah, I think those two and Azarenka are looking really, really good. I think Azarenka Rybakina feels like a final, but I think the winner of that could also lose to Sabalenka. So yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat you are. Like I don't know. Like they're and before even with Garcia and Pegula, I didn't really think they could lose to anyone either. Like there are a lot of players who kind of look not invincible, but like kind of unstoppable at the moment.
Yeah, Azarenka is fascinating. I think the Andy Murray love was deserved, and I'm glad he got his flowers and told off that doctor who I wonder yeah. if that actually happened, to be honest. But I'm sure
I got him 250,000 likes. So.
Take that, medical as a professional who helped me return to fitness. But Victoria Azarenka is a hell of a story in her own right. And oh, yeah. If you're a fan of the Moms Club and a mom winning a slam, I mean, that's a cool story. I think that's probably going to be hammered to death in the coming days. But 33 is not ancient, as we've long been proven to us by some of the people having the most success at slam. So I think this is a cool story. She's flagless as well, which I think keeps the conversation going in this regard, whether or not this means yeah. anything anymore, or what exactly are we doing here. I mean, she's playing Rybakina, who was kind of disowned by the tennis establishment after winning Wimbledon, or not really given any sort of credit for that in terms of court assignments. Like, it feels like there's yeah. a lot of like, hey, haters, we're still here and very good, and we're going to be in the conversation whether you like it or not. And then something about Karolina Pliskova discovering how to serve at this juncture again is really cool. But I think as you record, she might get bounced by arguably. Magda Linette, who did you have her as the last Polish player remaining at this stage of the tournament, Owen? Because I don't think anyone did.
I did not. I saw her beat Garcia, and she was down two breaks at the start of the match. I was like, okay, this is going how I thought it would. And then she freaking won. Yeah, you know, speaking of Iga, what did you think of her tournament? Because I think, like, you know, losing to that Rybakina is understandable, no matter who you are. But at the same time, it felt a little disappointing to me.
Yeah, I feel like there's a thing about some players just not having it at the beginning of the year, or just not being in the right yeah. place to be at their best to start the year. It's a long season. It barely stops. And I wonder if Iga is one of those players who's still figuring it out in terms of how to really best prepare for the start and having to travel across the world and stay somewhere for like a month at least, or a month right. plus, right? In terms of acclimatizing yourself and playing all the warm-up tournaments. So I don't know. Like, it looked like after she, like, Buxa was thrown out of the conversation after she yeah. stunned Bianca. I wonder, I really, really sad that we didn't get to see Świątek Bianca Andreescu, because I think that yeah. would have been very interesting. And kind of seeing Iga the next round, I wonder if Bianca could have pushed her too, because I think that would have been a hell of a match. But I do you buy anything to this? Like, did Rybakina just basically hit her off the court? Like, it's a thing that you can do against Iga, which was, like, it's not really the case. Like, defensively, I think she's upped her game a significant level, and she's got arguably the hardest forehand across both tours. But it felt like she was not powerful enough against Rybakina.
It's a good question. I think the answer is, like, yeah, Rybakina, like, kind of hit her off the court, but it wasn't like Świątek didn't have her chances, because she was up 3-0 in the second set, and she was down an early break and then got it back. And it seems like, okay, you know, she's reset, world number one. Now she's going to, you know, run away with it. And that just didn't happen. I didn't really love her tactics either. I thought sometimes she tried to trade forehands with Rybakina, which to me was a little like Federer trying to do it with Del Potro. It's like, your forehand.
He's like, I got a really good one. I'm going to keep hitting it because mine's really good, but it's not the best in this matchup right now.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you've got the better forehands technically, yes, but why would you push your luck like that? Like you have a weaker side to that. Just do it. I don't know. I mean, she talks a bit in press about, the pressure getting to her a little bit. And I think that's something that she's going to figure out over time, because I think mentally she's incredibly strong. But yeah, game-wise, I don't know. She looks more vulnerable than she did last year, even when the streak was not going on.
It's the cliche to say, like, I can see 10 people winning this tournament when it starts on the women's side. But holy hell, like, the list is growing, if anything, Owen. Like, there's more people who are now in this conversation, who, like, Donna Vekic is back and playing extremely well. Like, that's phenomenal to see. And she's got Pam Shriver in her corner, which I'm sure is helping as well. But there's so many players to get through, just to get there. Like, I was talking about this on Open Era, but Leila Fernandez not being seeded means she ends up having to go through Cornet and then Carol Garcia away.
Round two, yeah.
Right away.
She's like, insane.
That's it. Like, you have no time. You have no time to get into this because you're there and you're fighting for your life immediately. So you got to be seeded. You got to at least find your way into the top 10 so it's maybe slightly more manageable. But even then, there's so many landmines.
I mean, you're having these matches that feel like finals and, like, you know, round four quarterfinals, but also like round two, like you said. I mean, Fernandez Garcia felt like a final, really, like the last few points of that. Like, the atmosphere was insane. The points were so good. I think, you know, last year people kind of talked about, besides Iga, it was like, who can challenge her? Like, is the tour kind of weak? But like now, and like, I didn't really buy that then, but I think now, like, the tour feels super strong. Like, you still have a dominant number one in Swiatek, but now you have like a handful of players like Pegula, Rybakina, Sabalenka who can like challenge her and beat her. And I think the tour is in a really good place. Like, you have these landmines all over, but that also means like epic matches can happen in any round.
Yeah. I mean, consider the injuries as well. Like, I don't think Ons Jabeur was probably, she was not super fit. Paula Badosa withdrew, Tabjanovic withdrew. So, I mean, I still like Iga's chances of being the predominant force on the tour this season, and I think she'll get her big titles. But I think I'm going to say she's only going to win one slam this year, if that's controversial.
No, I like that take, and I think the slam that she wins will probably be Roland Garros again.
Right. Right.
I don't think it's going to be Wimbledon. I think the U.S. Open is just going to be so difficult for whoever wins it, because I mean, unless everyone is injured at that point, I think it'll be similar to here, and that there are going to be like 10 players who are all at the top of their games who could beat anyone. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, I think it's been a really good tournament on the women's side. Like, I'm really, really excited for the Rybakina Azarenka semi. I think the other semi will also be great.
I'm curious what you've thought so far regarding the play, the conversation regarding the tennis balls, whether it's been as slow as people have saying, because the reason why I think like Rybakina is here, and the reason why maybe on the men's side you're seeing some of the quote unquote smashers, like the guys who can hit the piss out of the ball, your Ben Sheltons, your Tommy Pauls, like, you got to hit through the ball. You can't really get by on I don't want to say pushing, but basically, right? Like, it feels like with the conditions the way they are, fortune favors the brave, and just almost some sort of justice in the sense that the rule is out where she is in that sense.
Because of the pusher comment she made about Halifax one time.
Exactly.
I mean, I do think we're seeing some of that. I think the Medvedev-Korda match is kind of emblematic of that. Like, you know, Medvedev is the finalist the last 2 years, went out in straight sets. And, you know, firepower from the baseline is not his strength, and I think we saw that. I mean, I think I'm not great at evaluating how fast or slow a court is when I watch, but I think, like, I mean, a lot of players have been talking about this. Like, you had
feels
Felix.
Like a thing, right? It yeah. feels like a thing if they're all mentioning it.
Yeah, I mean, when Felix said, I forgot what match it was, but he said to the umpire, like, look, I never complain about this, but like, these balls are crazy. Yeah. Like, you've got to yeah. do something. I was like, that feels like something we should listen to. Like, he seems like desperate. So yeah, I don't know. I hope they do a better job of it last year, because I think if you're ticking off this many players, then it's probably not great.
I mean, this has been a weird Australian Open for me to watch halfway around the world from you, Owen, because you're there. Right. But I think the coverage has been different, and the way it's been presented feels much different than in years past. I'm not saying it's like far worse or far better, but I think the, I don't know. It doesn't say how, carry that same Australian Open feeling as it has in years past, but I'm sure that's a couple of factors. Like, my ability to just watch straight through now is nearly gone. So I'm kind of having to select what I'm watching live, and I don't know. It's something feels different. I'm not saying again that it's bad, but it has a different feeling this year than years past. But I'm curious how you found just being there and like the atmosphere and the grind it is to like watch this much tennis there. Cause I feel like that is an underrated grind.
It is. Yeah. I mean, so the day before yesterday I had, day session at Rod Laver, and I watched one match, and then partway through the next one, which wasn't great, I was like, okay, I need to go get some food. I didn't want to buy food there because it's overpriced and not that great. And so I like left and went and got Mexican and then came back, and I, you know, scanned the thing, and they were like, oh, did you forget to like scan out when you left? And I was like, oh, I had to do that. So like, but the point I'm trying to make is like, I was kind of so like tired, not burned out, but I didn't even think to do that. I was like, oh, I'll like, I need a break, right, and then I'll come back. So yeah, it is kind of a grind. I mean, you had the latest ever finish, and I can kind of like give some details from being there. Like, so many people left in the middle of that match, Murray Kokkinakis, because like the trams stopped running. They needed to eat. All
the weeknight, right? People had to go to work the next
yeah,
day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Claire of Murray Musings, one of the three biggest right. Murray fans on this earth, like her phone died. And so she left in the middle of the third set because she had to catch the last tram, which she made by like 1 minute. I mean, it was crazy. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, and look, like the Australian Open is my favorite tournament. It's been my favorite tournament to watch. It's been amazing being here. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. It is exhausting. Like, I'm curious about what you said. Like, would you mind kind of elaborating on like what feels different about it? Because that's really interesting to me. Like, I know you said it's not a bad different, but it almost sounds like it is, if that makes sense.
It just feels like we're farther removed. And I never thought I would be that person who craved the talking heads being on set and being there, but I found myself wanting that. I found myself kind of wondering why we had people calling these matches in a studio in North America, you know, and I was maybe a bit afraid of what is to come in that space when it comes to coverage of this sport, because they have some huge decisions to make, like the stakeholders in this game. And I the conversation around the Netflix series, I think, has been good in the sense that it has generated a conversation, and it's maybe pushed people to think about the next step. And that's, how do you market the rest of this stuff? Like the whole other stuff that happens 340 days of the year, if not more. Like, what's the plan? And do they have a plan? And it doesn't seem like they do, really. And I'm wondering if the coverage that we are seeing for this slam is kind of emblematic of that. Even though it is a slam and it's a huge one and it's being held in a way different time zone, and that brings its whole other deal of logistical problems. I don't know. Like, again, this maybe goes back to what I was talking about when I first started watching the sport, but I didn't care about that stuff back then. I really didn't. And I didn't know any better. And it's not to say that I can know a lot more now, but I do have a bad feeling that it's going to get a little more fragmented rather than pushed together. And I think that'll only do a disservice to the fan that's trying to watch the stuff.
I think that's fascinating, and I think you're right. Like, and I feel like we kind of see that disconnect where, like, they're selling record numbers of tickets, and then you have ESPN that's like not televising the matches, and people are at home. They're like, you have to get ESPN Plus to watch this stuff. Like, ESPN is not doing their part to like cover the Australian Open. And what you said about Breakpoint, like, I, regardless of my personal feelings about the series, like, it is getting people talking about tennis. It's great, but I can say objectively about that doc, that does not prepare you for watching the Australian Open. Like,
No.
the experiences are completely
Do you
separate.
want the floor to go off on Breakpoint, by the way, on?
I
Do
kind of
you
would.
want
I'm
to
and
take your
I'm
please,
curious about your
please.
thoughts for it too. So my primary, and I'll preface this by saying the whole, like, it's not meant for me. Logically, I know that, but I couldn't internalize it as I watched. Like, I'd watch and they show footage of a point from early in a match and then show the scoreboard from late in the match. I'm like, this is literally wrong. Like, what the hell are you doing? That
But
annoyed
now
me.
you're just a film connoisseur, though. Now you're just looking for some coherence.
Right. But my primary issue with it was I don't think it was really a tennis doc. I think it was a tennis player's doc. You got to know the players, you learned a little bit about what makes them tick, but it didn't really show what it's like to play tennis. Like, they showed some points kind of with this weird back and forth filming style. Didn't really show any from the TV angle. The scoreboard was shown in this weird way. Like, I don't know. I think someone is going to watch Breakpoint and then try to watch tennis, and they're maybe not going to understand it, or they're going to think it's different from the way it was presented. And that made me sad as someone who just likes tennis a lot for what it is.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I hear you, but this just underlines what really, really wasn't for you, Owen.
Oh yes,
I think
absolutely.
because I here's the bet I think they made, and I'm not saying whether it was right or wrong, and I think we'll see if it pays off. But I think that they're betting on the fact that if you're going to like someone enough as an individual, as a person, you're willing to follow them in no matter what they do, and if that involves some tennis matches along the way, that'll include those matches, and you'll watch them because you're a fan of them. Specifically,
Yeah.
that's the bet I think they're making, and I think as a solo sport, an individual sport, it's not the worst idea, I don't think. But I think the difference is and what I saw they did with the F1 series is they did try to peel the curtain back in some regard regarding how the sport works and the politics of the sport and some of the more grimy aspects of the sport.
Yeah.
They were willing to do that. You didn't really get that, right? From these five episodes. And I thought if you wanted to show everything that makes tennis, or maybe all the aspects of it that make it so fascinating, and you didn't want to focus on the actual tennis part that much, which I agree with you, they probably should have a bit more, then you could have went some other ways. And maybe you could have pushed or had some more buy-in from the tours themselves to allow them to do that, because I'm sure there was pushback in that regard. But I was hoping for a little deeper, and I was hoping for more of the Tony Nadal being kind of sketchy, which I thought was the most fascinating aspect of this whole thing. And I'm like, yeah, more of that, please, because I always had a feeling, but now I knew for sure.
I agree with you. Like, and I think the director even talked a little bit about, like, the darkness of tennis was what fascinated him, and he wanted to capture that. But I think the part of it that they didn't really go after was, and it was kind of unspoken, but like it's the possibility that these players aren't going to achieve what they want, right? Like that's a legitimate possibility. Like they're dedicating their lives to this. They want to win a slam. For some of them, it's not going to happen. Like, and there, I feel like they could have like, okay, get a lost gen player. Say how like it's these same three damn guys who have been winning everything for 20 years. They were good enough to win a major and they didn't because they had shitty luck. And if they were born 10 years later, it would have happened for them. Like,
do you, I mean, do you think it was a bit strange that Maria Sharapova was like used as the arbiter kind of, or like the, you're like, this is what that means. Or like, this is how important this was. Like, I'm like, what? Like, why is it her?
I thought she was one of the better parts of the doc. Like, I thought her analysis was good, but I thought she was kind of used in a weird way. Like, she's a 5-time major champion, right? So she has a lot of experience to draw from, but she didn't really talk about her career. I think the closest she got was she was like, oh, I would have hated to play Ons. And I'm like, like that means a lot coming from a legend, but I feel like she could have said, like,
it was the expectation, like, everyone knows her, so that's all. We just put her there, everyone knows who she is, and that will. Once again, we'll see. And I think that we're talking about it in many ways. Maybe that is the gauge, but holy cow, this wasn't for us, Owen.
Oh my God, I know. I mean, and that, there were episodes I enjoyed like that.
Same.
I liked the second one and the fourth one and the fifth one the most, I think. Like, I thought Berrettini was compelling because he's the one
the fact that he wouldn't allow her to do the Tennis Channel hit in the same room was one of the more shocking things I've seen in some time. But that's why I'm not a pro tennis player, because I'm like, this relationship is doomed as hell. Holy cow.
Well, you were right. I mean,
we're all like, I felt awkward. I felt extremely awkward watching that, and I felt like I was watching a reality TV show, and maybe that's good television because I was captivated.
Yeah, I was too. So yeah, that part of it where like you see everything Berrettini's giving up, you see he's like, you know, maybe I would have a slam already if not for Novak. Like it focuses on him and then he loses anyway. And then you kind of the same thing in episode 5 with Felix and Rude. Like the Rude was just kind of sad because it builds it up and it starts showing the match and immediately he's like, yeah, I did my best. And you see the score line, which is grisly.
Smoke. The Rafa beating him before the match even started in the tunnel was pretty good. And also, Casper not really mentioning his dad was like a pro player at all was fascinating to me. I'm like, he's talking about having a poster of Rafa. I'm like, also your dad played on the ATP, man.
Like, right. You know, on this, you were talking with Karina, like, are you a Rude hater now because of the?
I think, like, honestly, the practice court thing is. Truly phase me, Owen. Truly phase. Treat these people with some respect is all I ask. It just felt very tennis player-y, if that makes sense.
It does. It didn't bother me as much as you, I think, but something that it sort of reminded me of was like when a match is going on, an umpire will make a call and the player goes over there and argues about it. And it's like, an umpire has literally never changed their call because a player argued with you. Like, all you were doing is throwing your weight around and being like a pissy child. Why are you doing this? And it's like, you know, tennis is frustrating. They need to vent their frustration, whatever. But it's also like, just be respectful, you know, like be an adult. Yeah. Like, I kind of get this with throwing rackets and balls too. Like, don't throw your toys, like break it against the ground, whatever. Like, don't hurt people. You know, the kind of a side effect of the Marie Kokkinakis match that was a little stomach turning for me was like being up close. Like, I saw he had a couple exchanges with Eva Ostrocki Moore that didn't make me feel great. He yelled at some people in the crowd. I saw a fan in the tunnel who was getting kicked out, who had apparently, like, Kokkinakis called him an unsavory name. And I'm just like, is it that hard to not do this stuff, guys? Like, really?
It, man, that's the stuff that I that's sports these days. Yeah. It's like you're watching this match on television and you see the disturbance, but you don't really know what's going on. But to see it live and kind of feel how thick the tension is, it's just, that's the good stuff. But yeah, I mean, Stefanos almost defaulting himself by hitting a ball kid in the final is, or like he's done this now already a couple times, but if he does this in the final against Novak, wouldn't that be the full arc if that's how Novak wins his next major?
Oh my God. That'd be very Tennessee.
But the crowd, it'd be super Tennessee. But the crowd, I mean, I thought the crowd would love Novak. They'd welcome him back, and they have. But I do think there's some weirdness left in this tournament. And I think something weird will happen regarding some abhorrent behavior or some just stupidity that will make a difference in a match. That's my bold prediction.
I think you're probably right. I don't want it to happen, but it does sort of feel like there's almost a bit of an icky tension that's like boiling to a point a little bit. Like, you know, another thing that I don't get from watching on TV is, and maybe this is like the way the TV people do the audio, but like you get the sense that like the crowd is silent during points, except like there's an epic shot and everyone goes like, oh, but like for the most part, it feels like people are quiet. But when you're there, like people shout between points like all the time. In Novak's second round match, I sat in front of a row of people who were like, I feel like viciously is the right word. They were viciously rooting for his opponent. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right.
Like, well, that was the match where there was that disturbance, right? When the heckler was booted.
Yeah, and I think the people behind me were similar. They were just far enough away that no one heard them. Like, it got to the point where people in front of us were like, hey, shut up. And then they were like, oh, are you going to yell at everyone who's like being obnoxious? And I was like, look, when you talk during the points, they can hear you. And they were like, oh, like, are you going to go tell off everyone who's doing that? I'm like, grow up, please. But like, that sort of thing affects people. Like Kokkinakis was, his temper was, you know, it was building up during that match. And I think late in the match, like he kind of calmed down a little bit, but there was a point where I was worried that something might happen. I don't know. I just hope it doesn't affect the result of the matches.
Me too. And I think it's a double-edged sword, and that's a terrible cliche, but I think there's some beautiful aspect of it that makes the Australian Open so special, that you do have this less buttoned down, more into a crowd. It might be four to 16 beers deep and having a good time and making it a lively atmosphere and going until super late in the morning. Like that is the tournament I fell in love with. But yeah, shut up when you can. Enjoy the tennis. Don't cause a scene. Don't cause a scene should basically be the motto. If you're going to a sporting event that doesn't involve you, that you're not participating in, don't cause a scene. That's it.
Yeah. And so this might be a tough question. I know it would be a tough question for me to answer. And it kind of goes back to what you said about, you know, becoming a more hardcore fan. Like when you're less into it, maybe like things make more sense. I think it's easier to tune out some stuff. Where do you think like the intense tennis fan goes from here, you know, in this world of more surface level Netflix docs and a lack of ESPN coverage? Like, do you think it's getting tougher to be a tennis fan, if that makes sense?
No, I don't think it's getting tougher. I think for a passionate diehard tennis fan, I would argue this is a positive time in the sense that you're able to turn on your television or your computer and find a compelling match basically all the time based on how many people are playing, how many events are being operated, how many excellent events are being operated below the WTA and ATP. If you go down to the challenger level and you see some of the players who are playing there and playing well and are surely worth watching in their own right, there's so much available. So in that sense, like if you're locked in, I think everything that's up to you. And I think we've seen people, we know people who do that, and it's incredible. But here's what I'll say. I think tennis is at not a risk, but time is finite. People don't have that much time. And I do wonder whether or not tennis is growing at the rate that it should be with some other things coming in the rearview mirror very fast. Like I'm watching all of these deals being signed by the pickleball people and wondering to myself, does that mean that tennis is moved beside them, or does that mean that's in place of tennis, or what, or what's the idea here, or what's going to be shown, or what is gaining access or to most people? I don't know if tennis is in a good place with that right now. So for the tennis obsessed, I think this is a good time, because we'll find them. We'll find these matches. We'll talk about them, whether it be on Twitter or your Discord channels or wherever. But I wonder how big that group really is. Like, I wonder how many people are in that conversation, because I think it's far less clearly than some of the other sports that would maybe be in the same conversation as tennis. Like, I think golf, or the conversation around golf, is a good comparison, or it's maybe not like for like, but there are some things that we can look at and say there's similarities. They're having some problems too with how they're marketing what's going on. And you had a whole breakaway tour exist because of that. Is tennis that far away from that? I wonder.
It's a great question. And I think what you said made me realize sort of what I'm trying to get at, which is that, like, I mean, you know, Tennis Channel trying to market pickleball, like, tennis, the powers that be, the powers that run tennis, I don't know how interested in tennis they are, if that makes sense. Like,
why didn't they show that much tennis in the Netflix doc, Owen, is I think probably a window into what those folks might be thinking over there as well, in to back your point.
Yeah.
Like, how much tennis do they think they have to show when they're called the Tennis Channel?
Right.
Like, it's a bit backwards, right? We're getting now to we went so heavy on subscriptions for everything that I think we lost some things along the way, and it really, I guess it's show what we took for granted, because like I just assumed that the Tennis Channel would show tennis all the time, but perhaps that was a foolish thing to believe in. I guess
I don't think it was foolish necessarily. I mean, yeah, like this push towards pickleball, when you have, I mean, it seems like pretty close to 100% of the tennis fan base out there is like abhors it, you know, like they hate watching it, they hate the existence of it, and yet you have the Tennis Channel being like, yeah, we're gonna show it instead of tennis sometimes. Like, yeah, I don't know, that a breakaway tour is an interesting idea. I don't know that tennis has it in itself to mobilize that many resources, but who knows.
Yeah, I think the story I'm watching this year as well, along with what's happening on the court. But what can the PTPA actually do now? There's some faces associated with it, some faces that people trust and respect across the tennis spectrum. I would say it's an interesting group. What can they do? What can they do to get more combined events? What can they do to maybe get tennis back into a better spot in terms of the consciousness of the sports fan in general, because there's some work to do here. And I guess the thing with pickleball is that it's growing, right? Like, they think, feel however you want to feel about it. It is growing. I think there's evidence behind that. I think tennis has shown that they have the ability to get huge numbers, to captivate huge amounts of people. But I think the ideas that have been generated thus far by the powers that be have kind of been the same thing we've seen over and over again. So while I was a bit skeptical of the PDPA in the beginning, mainly because I wasn't quite sure how they worked or how they were run, or whether or not it was an actual union, or whether or not they represented all the players. I mean, they didn't give us a lot of details, but I move beyond that, and I want to see what they can actually do, and what is the actual plan here. They have people in their leadership group who have experience in different sports, which I find interesting. So I'm willing to give them a shot, but I think that the ownership falls on them, and just as much as it falls on the slams and the real power players. Cause I think there's gotta be some push, a consolidated push by the workers here and the workers of the tennis players.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not entirely clear what the PTPA has done so far. Like, I think you can figure it out if you look hard enough, but I've been on their website, and there's this list of questions and mission statements, and then it's like, click for more, and you click for more, and it's like two sentences of the most language you can.
This is a deck. This is a PowerPoint deck, sir.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like you said, I think the council is like, it's great that they have players from the ATP and the WTA now, influential players, popular players. So yeah, but like maybe this is the start of something. But yeah, I don't know. And maybe this is why the Netflix series chose the angle it did. Like, I think in terms of popularity, like once the remaining legends like Nadal and Djokovic kind of are on their way out for good, like, I don't know. I think tennis could find itself in a crisis moment.
Here's my question for you.
All right.
You've been named the chief marketing officer of the newly formed tennis council. Again, we've just made this council up, but they got a lot of power now. They want you to choose one player that you think has the best combination, maybe of tennis ability and also personality to market tennis to a wider audience. Who's the player you're going to pick?
Either Alcaraz or Swiatek. Probably Alcaraz, because I think he has the better chance to win like 15 or something. I don't know. I think they should be marketing him more heavily. Obviously, like with him injured right now, there's not a ton you can do, but I would sell the crap out of him. What about you?
See, I think Alcaraz is a good shout, and like you can go Iga as well, and you wouldn't be wrong at all. But I really do think the fact that this person has to be American, and I feel like.
And do you think?
I think Ben Shelton. I think I'd pick Ben Shelton.
Already.
Yeah, wow. And we're in very dangerous Young Chun territory right now, where I hope we see Ben Shelton again after this tournament. But
you're gonna make him the next Hyun Chung.
I 20 years old, did the college thing, radiant personality, and someone you want to hear talk when they're done playing tennis. I might be overselling the American aspect, but I do think, like you mentioned, once the remaining legends are done, there's got to be a plan in place for the next level. And Netflix is one thing, but overall getting these players in front of more people, a non-traditional tennis audience, will be important. I think people like Ben Shelton will help sell the game. So I think I would pick him. But the reason I would pick him, Owen, is because I don't think Carlos Alcaraz is anonymous to a sports fan, but I do wonder if you have to start in a different place to bring different sorts of people in.
So let me ask you this then, with the American aspect of it, and I don't really know this because I got into tennis like 6.5 years ago during the Agassi Sampras era. Like, was tennis more in the mainstream than it is now? Like, you know, it's a very Euro dominated sport right now. Like, how important is that American aspect?
This could, again, fact check me on this, dear listeners, if this is just nostalgia taking over, but I definitely think it was more in the mainstream and part of the discourse in a different way, because it was on your flagship stations, it was on your CBSs and your NBCs, and simply put, more people had access to watch them. And I think because of that, and because they had a slew of Americans consistently making deep runs, it felt like more of an event that maybe not Americans are proud of, but it was just more of a staple. And not to say like that did the Federer Nadal Djokovic years and the Serena Venus years, and the fact that the end of the 90s on the women's side were also insane in terms of talent level. Like, they had so much available and so many excellent players. Like, I would argue that the end of the 90s and the early aughts were comparable to like the, whatever you want to call the prime Federer Nadal Djokovic years, like 2010, 2011, 2012, if you want to go there. Like, I would argue that era, that time, there's so many good players playing in front of so many people, easily accessible. So I would say, yeah, I think it was probably more of the conversation. But hasn't all of this kind of just been more more kind of as a, trying to phrase this correctly, but since then I feel like we've been more sectioned off in terms of our pursuits, like the sports we love. Like if you're going to be an NFL person, you're deep in the NFL, and like that's your sport, and you're going to follow that predominantly, you know, everything inside and out, and go to your media sources to find out what's going on about that. Just like there's tennis people who aren't too worried about the fragmentation of streaming and the fact that not a lot of stuff is available over the air on cable anymore. They're not worried about that because they have the subscriptions. They know when things are on. Their friends are tennis fans as well. They feel looped in. They're good. Like, I think a lot of what's happened is people have become specialists a bit in a way. And I wonder if back then people weren't as much, because it's kind of harder to be like that back then. You only had access to the things you had access to, and that was it.
Yeah. I do think you're right. I mean, I think what's clear is, like, you need a player who transcends, like, tennis, right? Like, and, you know, and that was Serena and that was Federer, and they, and like the football fan still knows who they are.
Right.
And I feel like Coco Gauff could be that as well. Like, I think to an extent she already is. Like, I think it's clear that she draws in more fans than a lot of other players, even some who are kind of winning,
and she's the answer to that question, the hypothetical question I posed, right? Like, and I think that is the plan. That is the plan right now.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm asking is, so like the answer to, you know, making tennis big again is like to get a new Andre Agassi, essentially.
Seriously, though, it would be great. It would be really great if somehow one of Ben Shelton or Tommy Paul won this tournament. And this will be dated by the time maybe this comes out, but it would be really great. And it would be happening at 3 a.m. stateside, midnight on the West Coast. But I bet you it'd be a big deal, and they'd make it a big deal.
Yeah, I am curious to see the viewing figures for the Shelton-Paul match. Like, I wonder if that is going to outperform other matches. And then, like, if it does, maybe that is something tennis marketing could run with, I guess. But yeah, it's kind of interesting to think that, like, it would be better for, like, I mean, obviously it'd be better for tennis popularity in the US if you got an American winner, but I know in my head it's like Djokovic is the only possible winner I can see,
both
because I think he's the favorite and because, like, you know, in my head and like as a Big Three fan, like that era is still going on, you know. I don't, sentimentally, I don't want it to be over yet, you know.
And here's the other thing. Is there, like, Novak is easy. I think Novak is in the top five of most known athletes at the current moment. I think that is a fair statement. Like, this guy is a mega, mega star.
Yeah, but probably Rafa too.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tennis is fine. Here's, maybe this is my thing, Owen. It's like tennis continues to believe everything is okay because they keep winning. These guys keep winning stuff. Exactly. So it's like, oh, okay, we can put this off. It's all right.
Right.
They'll be around. They'll be around.
Yeah, I do wonder if they're taking it for granted that, you know, Djokovic is going to win the 2027 Australian Open. And but if that doesn't happen, like, I am really curious to see what an alternate universe would look like where your Raonic's and Dimitrov's really did take over, and Nishikori. And, you know, I think, like, to an extent, it could have gone well. Like, Nishikori's got a ton of popularity. I think Dimitrov has that kind of Federer-esque game to an extent that could draw in a lot of casuals. But I wonder how differently things would have turned out if, like, this era ended when it was quote-unquote supposed to.
Well, there would be no Americans ready to take up the slack.
Right.
And I want a tennis, maybe it's way in a way different place in the conversation. Yeah. It's a very interesting what if. The Big Three era, which is still going on, will be studied well far beyond, I think, in terms of like the impact it made and what ended up happening during it, what it put off, what it helped prevent in terms of, like, where the sport is going. I still really, really believe that a merger is the best possible path forward because it will be hard to maintain the heights they reached in this era with Serena being as predominantly, like, just as so dominating as they were. Like, it's going to be really hard. So it's going to be massive change. And I know tennis has a really weird relationship with change because we see from time to time some interesting things tried, and some really cool things tried, and then at other times a real tough time with changing things up.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, so what do you think like a merger looks like? Is it like just sort of every tournament is like the majors where it's like men's and women's at the same site?
Yeah, I think basically that. I think what you have in Indian Wells in Miami is just replicated as many times as you can. And there is not like a team aspect, but I do think the camaraderie amongst the tours and the leveling the playing field and making this feel as if we are on an equal footing is important for the future of the sport, and also for the future of a sport that I think has an opportunity to champion themselves as being of the progressive nature and trying to facilitate a more even conversation when we talk about sports and who's playing them. Because as we mentioned time and time again, there's a hell of a lot of good tennis happening, and for a large part of that time, it's been happening on WTA side because they've been carrying the slack. So
yeah,
I think there's an opportunity there to be a leader in this regard. That being said, like, they wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel because they do this a lot of the time. And there's a basically, I'm not sure what the WTA has really done since deciding to not go to China anymore in terms of that financial windfall. And from what I've been reading recently, they have been reaching out to some random partners in the sense of like people who don't really have a tennis background. So that leads me to believe they're open to a lot of different things. Yeah. So who the hell knows what that means? But I think in terms of the longevity of the sport and the security of the sport going forward, it feels like joining together would be beneficial.
Yeah, no arguments for me there. I guess to kind of wrap up, was there anything else you wanted to add on the Australian Open predictions?
I first of all, I apologize so much for going on several long diatribes about the future of tennis.
No, I think it was great, and I initiated some of that. You're more than fine.
I'm freaked out, man. I'm freaked out. But no, here my final takes. Magda Linette is through, and the Cinderella story continues. But I want Rybakina, Sabalenka in the final really badly, and I'll stick with Sabalenka there. And let me just continue to be able to watch Tommy Paul play tennis in Melbourne at the Australian Open. Let that continue as long as possible. I won't make a prediction there because I do think this is Novak's tournament, but let the Tommy Paul reign continue, Owen, my final thought.
Okay, sounds like a good title for this episode. I personally think it's going to be a throwback to 2012 and 2013, and then we're going to have Djokovic and Azarenka.
Wow, yeah.
The future of tennis, indeed. But yeah, we'll see. I don't know. It's been an interesting tournament. I kind of wonder how we're all going to look back on it after it's over.
Same here. Enjoy the rest of your time there. Extremely jealous, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this. It was a lot of fun. I will try to get over the existential crisis of that last segment.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Owen.
Of course. Have a good one, man.
See ya.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.